Welcome to Art Waves. I'm Bernadette Rule, and my guest tonight is Dr. Alan Walker. Alan Walker is the author, most famously, of the definitive three-volume biography Franz Liszt, which received the James Tait Black Memorial Prize in Biography and the Royal Philharmonic Society Book Award, among other honors. His writing has been published in the Musical Quarterly, the Times Literary Supplement, and the Times Educational Supplement, among others. Professor Emeritus at McMaster University, Walker was made a Fellow of the Royal Society of Canada in 1984 and was awarded the Knight's Cross of the Order of Merit of the Republic of Hungary in 2012. His latest book is another biography, which is no doubt on its way to becoming a classic as well, Friedrich Chopin, A Life and Time. The Chopin biography was named Music Book of the Year by the Sunday Times of London in 2018 and was shortlisted for the Governor General's Literary Award in 2019. The book was published in Hungarian in May of 2020 with an online launch in Budapest and is presently being translated into Polish, Chinese, and Vietnamese for publication in those countries in 2021. It has also been reissued in paperback by Picador Press, a partner publishing house of the book's hardcover publisher, Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. Welcome back to Art Waves, Alan Walker.
Thank you so much for the invitation. It's very nice to be back.
Well, first of all, congratulations on this thoroughly researched biography of Chopin.
It's very nice of you to put it like that. One of the aims of being a writer, of course, is to find a readership. There's no point in writing a biography of Chopin or any other composer if it doesn't reach the people you're trying to reach. And so to make it as easy as possible has been a goal of mine. So I'm glad that you found it an easy read.
You know, it was absolutely thrilling, transfixing read, I would say. I was lucky enough to get it out of the library just before the pandemic lockdown began. And it got me through the first month very happily. I was just totally absorbed in the book. And now I have my own copy of it as well. So I did return that one to the library when I was finally able to do so about 3 months later. But I loved having it near me. I just think it's beautiful. Now, Liszt has long been your man, Dr. Walker, and you have famously said that it takes a life to write a life. What compelled you to go for two lives and to write about Chopin?
Well, as you know, it took the better part of 25 years, which I suppose is at least half a life, if not an entire life, to write the Liszt biography. And at the end of that very long and somewhat arduous process, I started to suffer from the literary equivalent of postpartum depression. I needed another project. And for me, this was a very simple matter, because although it may surprise you, Chopin was always my first love. I came across the music of Chopin as a child. And when I first started taking piano lessons, I quickly was able to play some of the simple mazurkas, some of the simple waltzes, and one or two of the simpler preludes. Chopin's music is not technically difficult, although it is, of course, filled with musical substance. But I fell in love with Chopin's music from a very early age. And for me, it seemed quite a natural thing just to go back to the beginning. And I thought, well, why don't I try to write a life of Chopin? I know there's a great deal of fantasy and make-believe and fiction associated with his life. And maybe I can write a biography which will at least be an improvement on the ones that are generally available. So that's how it all came about.
Okay, well, I want to talk to you more about how you knew or untrue issues in all of his biography, but did you take a different approach to this biography than you did to writing about Liszt? Was it necessary to take a different track?
No, I don't think I took a different approach, because whichever subject I had chosen, whichever personality I had wished to write a biography of, you have to do the same hard work. It's a question of familiarizing yourself with all the books that are readily available, the received image of the person in question, so to say, and then going out, finding the documents, diaries, correspondence, newspaper reports, the reminiscences of other people who might have known the subject in question, in an attempt to make absolutely certain that the narrative you are presently writing is built upon a solid foundation. The transmission of sources is extremely important. And it's in the course of transmitting those sources that you very often come up against the fantasies and the fictions that I mentioned a little earlier, which is why at the end of the day, when I submitted my Chopin biography to my publisher, they themselves decided to call it a corrective biography. That was not my term, that was theirs. But I don't object to it, because I was fortunate enough in the course of the 10 years or so that it took me to write the book, to come across all kinds of new and interesting information, which helps to improve, let us say, to sanitize the received record so that future scholars have something a little more worthwhile to work with.
Yes, there were many moments in the book where you would say, in the course of my research, I uncovered, you know, this original paper or whatever, and that was really interesting for the reader as well. So how did you know at the stage of intention and before doing this research, how did you know that the correction was needed?
In the course of doing preliminary investigations, it's necessary to meet with and discuss my work with other scholars. And it so happened that there were several scholars in Poland in particular who had done sterling work over the years, but their work had never found its way into the biographies, particularly in the English-speaking countries. I'm thinking as I speak of a genealogist who was based in Warsaw. Again, I'm thinking of a medical doctor who was based in the city of Wrocław. And such people writing medical papers, genealogical papers, giving hints here and there of new things that had come to light about Chopin. When I came across all this information, I realized that one of my first duties would be to weave it into a new kind of biographical narrative. And so that is why my publisher decided to call it a corrective biography. And that is how, to answer your question, I came across this information. Some of it I did come across in my own time, in my own way, but mostly I think the things that you're thinking of, the improvements and corrections, were already there on the record, but in virtually unobtainable sources, in Polish in particular, which is not a language which is understood every day in the English-speaking world.
Do you speak Polish?
No, I don't. And it may seem strange that it would be possible for me to write such a biography with hardly any knowledge of the Polish language, but I have help. Indeed, it would be foolish to write such a biography without having daily access to scholars who can help me with translations and such like. That was a lesson that I learned in the case of Liszt. I could hardly speak a word of Hungarian there either, but that did not prevent me from writing those three volumes about Liszt. Very often, people have said, well, it must have been hard work to have to consult people all the time with translations, and indeed it was, but it was absolutely necessary. And I have to say that even if I'd been completely bilingual in both Polish and in Hungarian, it would still have been necessary for me to consult experts, because you always have to have your work checked by somebody. It would be an act of irresponsibility just to go forward and publish a book like this without the various experts in their various fields, including the field of linguistics, and not to look at the work first.
Well, I don't think anyone can accuse you of anything remotely irresponsible when it comes to writing biographies, Alan Walker. Now, before we leave Liszt, the two composers, Liszt and Chopin, were contemporaries, and they actually knew each other fairly well. They gave concerts together. They moved in overlapping circles, but they had a falling out. Can you tell us what the falling out was about?
Well, it really fell into two parts. You're absolutely correct that there was a warm friendship between the two composers in the early days. When Chopin first arrived in Paris in 1831, he was hardly known, and it was Franz Liszt, who was already there and world famous, who opened many doors for the young Chopin, and they became firm friends, so friendly, in fact, that two or three years later, Chopin was able to dedicate the first volume of his 12 studies, Opus 10, to Franz Liszt as an example of his friendship and admiration for Liszt the pianist. They had a falling out because, and it's one of those things that it's so silly when one tries to put it into words, but it had a human face to it and there were ruffled feelings. Chopin's publisher, Camille Pleyel, had a very beautiful wife, a concert pianist, Marie Mocker, and she and Liszt had a little tryst. And Liszt decided to meet Marie Mocker in the apartments rented by Chopin while Chopin was out of town. Chopin didn't know about this. Under normal conditions, it wouldn't have mattered very much. Chopin was not all that squeamish, but it so happened that Marie Mocker was the wife of his publisher, and therefore he felt affronted. And we know that he was offended, because he writes about this at some length. And although Liszt tried to patch up the difference, there was thereafter always some distance between the two composers. Now, I said that the quarrel fell into two parts. The other part was musical. Although Chopin deeply admired Liszt the pianist, he did not admire Liszt the composer. And when the newspapers of Europe started being filled with headline news about Liszt's triumphal tours in the various countries, in Italy and Germany and the Netherlands and in the Balkans, as well as Spain and Portugal and France, Chopin came to the conclusion that Liszt was simply in pursuit of newspaper glory. And this offended his sense of what art should really be. So there was both this personal and this artistic difference between them. There were meetings between the two composers as the years rolled by, but I think the last one probably took place in 1945 or 1946. And
1845?
18, I'm so sorry, yes. You see, I'm so deeply rooted in the Romantic period, the 19th century, that I get my centuries mixed up. All that aside, when Chopin died, Liszt decided that he wanted to write a biography of the great composer, and he succeeded in doing so. The very first time, by the way, in the history of music, as far as I can tell, that one great composer had taken time to write a biography about another. So it was an uneven friendship, and the idea that it was one long love-in, one long admiration fest, is an idea that's been promoted by Hollywood and the popular biographies of both Liszt and Chopin, but it's not based on the evidence.
Okay. For you personally, Alan Walker, having written a biography of both these men and feeling, as you say, very deeply rooted in their lives and time, did you find yourself taking sides in the rupture between the two composers?
No, and I hope that no one would come forward and say, you favored Liszt over Chopin or Chopin over Liszt. I tried to take an even-handed view, and I treated both composers with the same dispassion, as far as I'm able to. I don't think any biographer can be truly dispassionate, because after all, the best biographies are based on the love of the topic, not the dislike or the hatred. Hatred closes doors, dislike slams them shut. Love opens doors, and it allows the biographer to reveal truths that might otherwise have remained hidden. But having said all that, I think my approach to both composers was roughly the same. And based on evidence, I quote the evidence throughout the books. And probably as a reader of both of the books, you will be the first to appreciate that I always disclose my sources as I go along. That's why I've always insisted on footnotes rather than endnotes, so the reader knows at once where any major statement, let alone the minor ones, where they come from. They don't come from my imagination, but they're based on documents.
Right, and I have to say, as a reader of the book, that I had to read all the notes too. It was not my full intention to go that deeply and read every little thing to prepare for the interview, but I just was compelled to because the material and the way you wrote them. It was just quite, I can't say enough, Art Waves listeners, that this is a book you should read. I am speaking tonight with Dr. Alan Walker, who has just released, or fairly recently released, Friedrich Chopin, A Life and Times, a biography of the composer. And it is so well worth your time, let me just say. I am not a musician, and I'm certainly not terribly knowledgeable about classical music, though I listen to it all the time on the radio. I have to say, this is a page-turner. It's crazy. It's so well done. And that is speaking from the outside of it all. So, okay, let's go back to some of the myths and legends that you wanted to overturn when you wrote this book on Chopin. What were some of those?
Well, it's not true, for example, that when Chopin first left Warsaw on his European tours, that he took a sample of Polish earth with him that might be buried with him when he died. He had no idea that he was going to leave Poland for good at that point. And he'd been on tour away from Warsaw several times. He'd never been known to take an urn of Polish soil with him, so why should he on this occasion? So that never took place. There was no Polish earth buried with him at the time of his funeral. It's an idea that has been projected back in time onto this event. a sample of Polish earth was indeed sent to Paris to be sprinkled over his grave, but by then he was already dead and buried. So the idea, the romantic idea that the earth was buried with Chopin was never based on any evidence at all. And of course, another thing, it's not true that the deathbed note that he was supposed to have scribbled, asking that he not be buried alive, that his heart be removed, we know that that note was written years earlier by Chopin's father, Nicolai Chopin, on his deathbed, and the handwriting was confused. Another example, of course, the scatological letters that Chopin was supposed to have written to Countess Delfina Potocka. He had no passionate affair. They're all forgeries. We know who wrote them. And I deal with this matter, of course, in the epilogue of the book. But it's amazing how many modern biographers have fallen victim to the story and think that Chopin was capable of writing such letters with lavatorial humor and four-letter words, which had never been associated with him in any other branch of his correspondence. But on this occasion, everyone was willing to agree that he could have written those letters. But they were submitted eventually to the forensic department of the Warsaw police station, and forensic experts were brought in, and it was proved beyond doubt that the handwriting was not his. And okay. The list really goes on. It's not true, for example, that the cause of Chopin's death was cystic fibrosis. It's now been demonstrated beyond all reasonable doubt that his death was caused by tuberculosis. And this was a disease, of course, that had killed two of his family members and a whole circle of his friends in Warsaw. Tuberculosis was rampant in Poland and Eastern Europe. It's been estimated, in fact, that a fifth of the population of Poland suffered from tuberculosis. So it's not surprising that Chopin became a victim of this. But in order to, I suppose, hyphenate their names next to Chopin, in order to make some kind of dent, some kind of memory of their appearance on this earth, there were some medical doctors who decided they wanted to upturn this verdict and decided that it must have been cystic fibrosis, the symptoms of which, incidentally, are remarkably similar to those of tuberculosis. Cystic fibrosis as a disease did not exist in Chopin's time, had not been identified. It's a modern identification, and it has led to a great deal of turbulence and argumentation in Chopin scholars. As you remember, in an attempt to settle this problem, Chopin's heart was removed from the pillar of the Church of the Holy Cross in Warsaw, and it was subjected to a visual inspection. And the forensic medical people who were present at that time had no doubt from a visual inspection of the heart that it must have been tuberculosis that had killed Chopin.
Yeah.
That's a story. I go into all the details in my biography.
Mm-hmm. You know, it did strike me, Alan Walker, when I was reading the book, that particularly when I was reading the epilogue, that you could almost have had another trilogy here. There's enough material for sure.
Yes, but I'm not sure that I have another 25 years.
I don't know at the rate you're going. I think you're gonna be able to do it. It's incredible, really, how much work you did on this book and how you pulled it together. This one took you how long to write?
It took 10 years. Yes, the book took 10 years to write.
10 years for this one, 25 for the other one. And next one we'll have to talk about. So you state early in the book, on page 8, in fact, you say it can easily be shown that more of Chopin's music is now alive and well in the concert hall, proportionate to his relatively small output, than that of any other composer. Why do you think, Alan Walker, that his music is more popular than that of other composers in this way?
Well, Chopin himself provides part of the answer, which may seem rather an odd thing to say. He was once playing some of his mazurkas to an audience in Paris. And one of the members of the audience, after he'd finished playing, put the same point to him. What is it about the music that carries such a feeling of power and draws one into it? And Chopin himself couldn't at first answer this question. He pondered it for a while, and then he came up with a Polish word, żal. And he kept on repeating it. We have this story, by the way, from Franz Liszt, who was present in that audience and wrote about it in his book. The Polish word żal apparently can mean many things. It can mean regret. It can mean nostalgia. It can mean grief. And it can mean melancholy. And it can actually mean a combination of all these things. And the moment you mention that word to a Pole, Zhal, they know immediately what's going on. All the nostalgia comes rolling to the surface. It's a very Slavic idea. And Chopin was really saying, if you find my music compelling and interesting, it's because of this element of Zhal, which is there inside it. And many composers, many pianists, many people who love Chopin and have thought about this question have all come to the same conclusion. And Arthur Rubinstein puts it very well when he said, when we hear Chopin's music, it's like coming home. It's like a homeland. We seem to belong there. Now, you will find the rare individual, even the rare pianist, which is rather a strange thing to say, they don't like Chopin's music. Now, that's, I think, autobiographical. It's up to them to explain something that they don't feel that the rest of the world does feel. But I think that's probably the best answer that I can provide, why Chopin's music is so much so alive and well. And of course, the other thing is that he was a perfectionist. He never allowed anything to be published on which he had not put a final polish. There were many manuscripts left unpublished at his death, and that's because he felt that he could go on improving them. But the obsession that he had with putting a final polish on everything before he allowed the world to see it is one of the reasons, I think, why his music has survived. Because there's a perfection there when you hear it, and you realize that it can't be done in any other way. And like many masterpieces, and this surely is one of the definitions of a masterpiece, it can't be consumed through use. Every time you hear it, it goes on calling out for its own repetition. And I can't think of many works by Chopin of which that is not true. When you hear them, you think, I'd like to hear that again.
It's true.
You can't say that of many works of other composers. I can think of some exceptions, but the fact is with Chopin, nearly every work we hear, I'd like to hear that again. It's nice. It carries me to my homeland. I want to be with this piece. It's the kind of music that if you were a composer, you would have been proud to compose it yourself.
Right. And apparently he was a master of improvisation as well. So when he played in all these little drawing rooms, you might get various versions of what he was working on, which I find a fascinating concept too.
That's a very good point. Practically everything that Chopin composed started out as an improvisation. And he would sometimes improvise for hours in public and in private. And the act of composing would then take over. Now it's been said that Chopin the composer was absolutely ruthless when it came to dealing with Chopin the improviser. The improviser had freedom. He could do whatever he wished. Chopin the composer said, no, not so fast. You can't go there. It's okay if you're improvising, where it's on its way to Mars and no one's going to hear it again. But if you're going to put this in the form of a ballad or a scherzo or a study, it has to be perfect. And so he would go over and over this initial improvisation time and again, trying to notate something that he, to capture it on the wing, so to say, that something that was so fleeting. And then he would agonize, in the words of George Sand, for 6 weeks over a single page, trying to get everything to that perfect point where he would allow the world to see it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is a part of the answer to your question of why his music is still in such a large proportion alive and well in the concert hall.
Yes, no question. And you know, just to go briefly to this Polish word Zhal, the idea that he felt the nostalgia and the grief that he plays in his music, part of it may have been he was not well and he had death all around him through TB, as you have noted. But part of it also may have been that he never got home again. This is one of the very affecting things. I kept thinking, why doesn't he just go home and see his parents? He misses them so much, you know? Well, and he was so happy to see his sister when she came to visit. Why on earth couldn't he just go home every now and again?
Well, that's a very good question, because in fact, he could have gone home. He was never a part of the revolution. The revolution broke out after he'd left Warsaw. He was actually in Vienna. And he had to look at this catastrophe happening to his country and the Russian invasion and the destruction of everything he held dear. He had to look at it from a distance. Now, at first, there was real danger. He was warned not to go back by his parents. So he sought refuge in Paris. And once he arrived there and established himself professionally, it would have become increasingly difficult to break away and go back to Warsaw, because after all, the reason he'd left Warsaw in the first place was to generate an international reputation, which he could not have done had he stayed at home. But then it was initially impossible for him to return. There was no money, there was no food, people were starving, thousands of people were dying, and his own family were in danger for a long period of time. But then, to get to the root of your question, it did become possible. The Tsar of Russia invited him to become the pianist in residence at the royal court in St. Petersburg, and Chopin turned him down. And he said, I can't accept this invitation. Although I never took part in the revolution, I identified with those who did. And so I'm willing to accept their fate. And so it was a self-imposed exile. And sometimes an exile that is self-imposed is worse for the individual than one that is actually imposed from outside.
Oh, yes. Well, very well answered, Dr. Alan Walker. So thoughtful and informed and engaging. Honestly, I love it. All right. Now, near the end of the prologue of your biography of Chopin, you say this: one thing is beyond dispute, and it's all the biographer requires to keep his pen moving. Chopin's music keeps an interest in his life alive. What kind of person wrote it? When and where did he live? And with whom? What were the conditions that aroused his creative processes? Let me substitute Alan Walker for Chopin and turn the tables. What are the elements in your life that made you a biographer, specifically a biographer of romantic composers?
Well, that's a difficult question to answer. I suppose I'd have to fall back on a familiar line of the poet William Wordsworth, that the child is father of the man. Many of the things that we do in adult life have their roots in childhood. They're variations of childhood interests. And if that is true in my case, and I have every reason to suppose that it is, I would have to say that my early interest in music, and piano music especially, led me quite quickly to the music of Chopin and Liszt. And I became interested in their life stories. I listened to BBC radio a lot. I grew up in wartime England, when the BBC was listened to by the entire nation, and had very little money to buy gramophone records. But fortunately, BBC radio was filled with classical music. And I remember listening on one occasion to a piano recital, and it had an extraordinary effect on me. I suppose I was 8 or 9 years old. And I listened to this music, and I thought, I want to be a musician. I want to be a pianist. I want to be able to do this. And that was a turning point in my life. And thereafter, when anyone asked me what I wanted to do or wanted to be, I said without any hesitation, I want to go into the field of music. Now, my parents were against this. They thought it was an unreliable profession. And I grew up in a very small industrial town in the northeast of England. And practically every family that I knew, the breadwinner, worked in the local factory. And that's where most of my school friends ended up working as well. And I resisted that. It was a difficult time, because if you resist your friends and if you resist your parents, then it's a difficult thing to do as a teenager. But I stuck by my guns, and I got a couple of diplomas in piano playing from the Royal College of Music and the Guildhall School of Music, and I was teaching piano. I had my own studio, actually, when I was 18 years old. There was a local school of music. We had just 2 decent piano teachers in our small town, and I took lessons from one of them. He ran a music school, and he said, would you like to come and teach for us? I had a diploma by then. By the time I was 18, I think I had 35 students. And you know, there's an old saying, a very true saying by Arnold Schoenberg. It's the dedication line of his book on harmony and counterpoint. And he said, I learned this book from my students. The moment I started teaching, I myself started to make really good progress as a pianist, because I saw my faults reflected in them. And by correcting their faults, I was able to help myself.
Yes, that's so true, isn't it?
I went down to London, of course, and I studied at the Guildhall School of Music and ended up teaching there, and then took degrees at the University of Durham. So that's a long answer to your question, but I think to refer to my starting point, you have to go back to your childhood to explain how it is that, in my case, I was writing biographies in my adulthood of Chopin and Liszt. Don't forget my orphan child. No one ever mentions it, but it's the best biography I've ever written, biography of Hans von Bülow, the pupil and son-in-law of Franz Liszt. I derive pleasure from writing that book, and I think the book reads far better than anything else I've ever written, but no one knows about it. So I'm taking this advantage to mention it.
I'll have to look it up. What is the title of it?
Hans von Bülow, A Life and Times.
A Life and Times. All right, we're back to that title, which is very apt because you really do bring the life in its context of its time alive for the reader. All right, so Alan Walker, how old were you when you began piano? You knew you wanted to take piano and started lessons at what age?
I was eight when I first took my first piano lessons. Before that, for 1 year, I had studied the violin. And before that, when I was six, I started to play a brass instrument. So I was able to read music notation from quite an early age. But first the brass instrument, then the violin, and then finally the piano. And I stuck with the piano for a very long time.
All right. So Alan Walker, let's come back to Chopin. You say that as a teenager, when he was writing a sophisticated nocturne, which some have claimed he couldn't have written at that age, Chopin had the ability to, and I quote, borrow from his future self the prerogative of genius. Can you enlarge on the lovely concept?
It's probably best expressed in a phrase of Robert Schumann when he first heard the music of the young Brahms, that Brahms had sprung from the head of Zeus, fully armed. Insofar as one can believe in the concept of genius, if it makes any sense at all, that the genius is born fully armed. And it's merely a question across the years of discovering within him or herself what the possibilities are. Now, in the case of Chopin, the nocturne you mention in E minor, we have no doubt, based not on musical, but on the physical evidence of the manuscript and rastrology and the evidence of people who were familiar with the young Chopin and knew that piece, that he wrote it when he was about 17 years old. And in recent years, there's at least one very prominent Polish scholar who's written a very fine biography of Chopin who said this is impossible. This work could not have come from a 17-year-old because it shows so much sophistication in the melody, in the harmonic progression, the layout of the ideas across the keyboard. The 17-year-old Chopin was incapable of doing this. So my response was, well, just look at the later nocturnes and you see all these things there deployed across the keyboard. Isn't it possible that since he was a genius, and no one argues against this, that he was borrowing from himself?
And yes, it's a lovely phrase.
I see no reason. After all, we borrow from our past. So why shouldn't we borrow from our future? If we're born fully armed, we just have to find a way of reaching out to our future and borrowing from our future self.
Oh, I love the concept. It's wonderful, Alan Walker. All right, so after examining Chopin's Sonata in B minor, opus 57, his Berceuse, which you call a cradle song to end all cradle songs, you allude to the Chinese legend of the emperor who cut open the throat of a nightingale to examine its song as a metaphor for the futility of trying to examine a work as enchanting as the Berceuse. Now, you did this after examining it very competently, it seemed to me, and very beautifully. It's quite a neat circle. Do you have a favorite Chopin piece yourself?
Well, yes, I do. But we have to put it into context. If by favorite piece, you mean one piece by Chopin that I favor above all others, then I think I could select one. But again, we have to provide context. Let us suppose that I was being condemned to spend my entire life on a desert island and without any company of any kind. I had enough food and water, of course, and I had a gramophone player, record player, and I could have one piece of music to keep me company into infinity, or at any rate, into the rest of whatever years were left to me. I think I would choose the Sonata in B minor, opus 58. And the reason it touches on something we discussed a little earlier. It is filled with the most wonderful Chopin melodies, the most wonderful progression of harmonies. It reveals Chopin's approach to large-scale structure, which he was more than capable of holding together, despite the word of many critics who think that he was not a large-scale composer. But more than that, It fulfills the requirements of a masterpiece. It cannot be consumed through use. And that would be vital if I were on a desert island. It's work that calls out for its own repetition. It's a long work. It lasts for the better part with the repeats of half an hour. But I have to say, I've heard that work more times than I can care to tell you about. And I'm never tired of it. And the moment I hear the closing chords of the last movement, I look at my watch and I say, I wonder if I have time to listen to this again. No matter how many times I've heard it, that's the thought that crosses my mind.
Oh, that's lovely. Okay, now let's get to the really interesting, juicy bit here. George Sand and Chopin were a famous power couple of the 19th century. Can you talk a little bit about their relationship and the effect they had on one another as artists?
Well, it is true what you say, one of the famous couples, love affairs of the 19th century, aided and abetted by all the popular biographies of both these individuals, as well as by Hollywood. And yet there's very little truth to the idea. There was, of course, a love affair, but it expired very, very quickly. And from lover, after about a year, perhaps less, the role of George Sand became that of caregiver to Chopin. He became extremely ill within the first few weeks of the beginning of their intimate relationship. They went to the island of Mallorca, as everyone knows. It's one of the most famous parts of Chopin's biography. And he became extremely ill there. And Sand suddenly realized that instead of a lover, she had a very sick man on her hands. That there was love between them is no doubt, that cannot be doubted. But any passion that was shared between them in the first few months quickly changed into caregiving, and not exactly sister and brother, but it's well known, even by especially by the George Sand scholars, that within a year of their first falling in love with one another, they had ceased to have sexual relations. George Sand scratched on the embrasure of one of her windowsills in her ancestral home of Nord in France, a date. I think it's June 1839. There's an actual date there, which I can't remember as we speak. And all the scholars of George Sand agree that that is the date in which she was declaring that she was now mistress of her own bedroom and that Chopin was no longer welcome there. It's a very sensitive subject. I've gone into it in great depth. No one has challenged me. Many people have said, yes, this is what all the evidence suggests, all the correspondence and all the evidence shared among their mutual friends. And maybe for the first time, I've told the stories I think it actually should be told. And it's far from being a romantic affair that was simply terminated by Chopin's death. George Sand herself terminated it because there was this monumental quarrel between Solange and George Sand in which Chopin took the part of the daughter. It's a long story. It would serve no purpose to go into the details here, but your main point has been addressed, and anyone wanting further details will find them in my book.
Well done. All right, Alan Walker, let me just remind our listeners, if you've tuned in late, that you are tuned in to Art Waves. I'm Bernadette Ruhl, and my guest tonight is the inimitable and brilliant Alan Walker, and I'm talking to him about his latest book, The Biography of Chopin. All right, so Alan Walker, you express a belief that there's evidence in the last 2 years or so of Chopin's work that had he lived even another 10 years or so, he would have perfected some of the tentative experiments with bold innovations that he was beginning to explore, having to do with a mingling of different forms and genres. Did any composer after Chopin go in the direction you envision him taking? I know this is an impossible question, but let me rephrase it. What composer do you think is Chopin's truest musical heir?
Well, that is a difficult question, as you say. Many later composers have paid homage to Chopin, including Debussy and Prokofiev, Rachmaninoff, and others. But your question is a little deeper. You're actually looking for at least one composer who might justly be regarded as Chopin's heir, someone who perhaps lived in the 20th century, who composed the kind of music that Chopin himself might have composed had he lived that long. And I think there is one such composer, and it may surprise you, and I've given this matter quite a lot of thought. I would say Alexandra Scriabin. It would be impossible for Scriabin to have written his nocturnes, his studies, and various other genre pieces that Chopin himself composed so very well, without Chopin being in the background. And in fact, the D-sharp minor etude of Scriabin would be absolutely unthinkable without Chopin's revolutionary study sounding in the background. This is a piece in which if some present-day musicologist were to come along and say, folks, there's been a big mistake here. This D-sharp minor etude of Scriabin, we can now prove that it was not written by Scriabin at all. It's really an unknown work of Frédéric Chopin. On the musical evidence, you would not be able to dispute that conclusion because it is so much like Chopin. Another name that comes to mind, of course, although he's a very different kind of composer, is Rachmaninoff. And I don't say this because Rachmaninoff's style is like Chopin's style, but there's one work, and I'm thinking of the Elegy for Piano by Rachmaninoff. It's very, very like a Chopin nocturne. That is the kind of music that Chopin might have written had he lived into the next generation, had he lived into the 20th century. So my first choice would be Scriabin.
How satisfying for me to get an answer like that from you. Thank you for giving it some thought. That's wonderful. I'll have to look up all these pieces of music now and listen to them as I did while I was reading the book. I had to keep looking up music and listening to it when you were talking about a particular piece. Okay, so I wanted to ask about the dances, the mazurkas and so forth, these Polish dances that you seem to think about with such knowledge. You say that the Polonaise in F-sharp minor, opus 44, incorporates an unlikely mazurka into the middle, right into the middle. You say, it's as if the dancers in a stately ballroom had been abruptly swept into the village square. Then you find, through your research, that the mazurka was actually composed as a separate sketch originally before it was incorporated into the Polonaise. How did you learn so much about these dances? How did you know all that? And how did you feel when you found that sketch of the mazurka?
Well, I think the piece you're referring to, the F-sharp minor Polonaise, I wrote about it because its structure is quite unique. It combines the form of a Polonaise with that of a mazurka. And that's one reason that I wanted to write about this piece, because it's unique in that regard. Your wider question, of course, Chopin's interest in the mazurka and the Polonaise leads one into a very important area. Chopin was really the first composer to bring these national dances into the concert hall. I think it's quite wrong to talk about Chopin's mazurkas. It's quite wrong to talk about Chopin's Polonaises. What I think is a better way to look at these pieces is that Chopin wrote mazurkas about mazurkas. He wrote Polonaises about Polonaises. They're works of reminiscence. No one would dream of dancing to a Chopin mazurka or dancing to a Chopin Polonaise. The Polonaise, as you know, is a dance of the aristocrats, and the mazurka is a dance of the peasants. One dance comes in from the village square, another dance comes in from the ballroom. But Chopin made them uniquely his own and brought them both onto the concert platform and made them an integral part of the solo piano repertoire. And other composers came along after him and wrote also Polonaise and mazurkas, even those composers who were not even remotely Polish. But the way to look at them, I think, is that they're reminiscences, and it would harm them to simply return them to their folkloristic or their aristocratic roots and make them pieces of utilitarian music, music to be used, music to be served as a background against a choreography. These are foreground pieces which demand our 100% attention, and one must never be tempted to dance to them.
All right, I'll make sure I never do. All right, Alan Walker, who is next?
The long pause suggests that I'm not really certain. I am at the moment, of course, because of COVID, like everybody else, I'm trapped in my house, but I don't object because writing is a very solitary activity anyway. And whether you impose this solitary life on yourself, which most writers have to do, or whether it's imposed from outside, which is happening to everybody at the moment, you just use the time in the best way. I am working on a revision of the Chopin book, And already I've offered another 25,000 words to my publisher, and they are now considering whether to issue a second edition, but that's all something for the future. But as far as biography is concerned, I'm not sure that I will attempt another one. I might be interested in attempting an autobiography, and that would probably bring us back together again in a few years' time.
Oh, that would be very interesting. As I said, you can't really read your books without wondering about the person who wrote these, you know? So yes, I'd be first in line if you wrote an autobiography, Alan Walker. That would be very interesting and most welcome. I was going to ask how you're getting through the COVID-19 pandemic shutdown, but you've already answered that. You're writing away all the time, and you've got your 3,000 books there to work with, and your piano and all of it that you need. So yeah, that's wonderful, because I know when I ran into you and invited you to be on the show again, you were just back from, I don't know, England or someplace, and you were on your way to Southern United States, or, you know, you were just, you said you might be able to catch me in April or May. And then this all happened.
Here we are. It's August.
quite amazing, all of it, really, but fascinating. So I wish that we had another hour to talk, but unfortunately we don't. So let me ask you what piece of music that we're going to close Art Waves with tonight, and why particularly that one?
Probably the best thing to close the conversation with would be the great Polonaise in A-flat major, Opus 53. It's world famous. It's been popularized by Hollywood. All the great concert pianists seem to have recorded it. And it's instantly recognizable by the man in the street. He knows exactly this is by Chopin. The Poles have embraced it. It's almost a kind of national anthem. It's called the Heroic Polonaise because there are heroic elements in it. And it's associated with Chopin's life at every step of the way. So I thought that would be a very good piece with which to end our conversation. It's a rousing piece, and our excerpt, whichever excerpt you choose from it, would have that famous left-hand passage going round and round, which is redolent of the Polish cavalry getting ready for their charge. This was the famous image that Liszt attached to that passage when he taught this piece in his famous masterclasses years after Chopin's death. It's an image that was not put there by Chopin, but everyone thinks about it when the pianist comes forward, walks onto the platform, sits down, and launches into this most wonderful piece, a Polonaise. Mm-hmm. And again, to remind you, it's a Polonaise about Polonaises.
Mm-hmm. All right. Wonderfully well said, Alan Walker. I can't thank you enough for being my guest tonight on Art Waves. It's been wonderful, as I knew it would be.
Thank you so much. It's most nice of you to have this conversation with me. Thank you.
It was great. I did want to ask where people would be able to hear you speak about the book and so on. I suppose that's probably not too possible now, except on things like this interview. Is there anything you'd like to mention to our listeners?
Yes, there are lectures of mine on YouTube. And so all you have to do is to put my name in and that of Chopin. And there are two lectures that I gave in the Library of Congress, which were videotaped and are now widely available. One is on Liszt and the other is on Chopin.
Perfect.
And I think that would probably give your listeners some additional ideas to think about.
No doubt. All right. So you heard it here first. Listeners, go to YouTube, type in Alan Walker, that's A-L-A-N Walker, and Liszt or Chopin, and you will come up with the Library of Congress lectures that he gave on these two great composers. Again, thank you so much, Alan Walker. Wonderful to have you on tonight.
Thanks and goodbye.
We thank our listeners as well for tuning in. I hope you can join us every Sunday night on 101.5 The Hawk at 7 p.m. for an interesting conversation with Hamilton artists of all kinds. And you can always find the podcasts of our programs at archive.org/details/artwaves. So I hope you can join us again next week. And until then, this is Bernadette Rule wishing you a good night on the shores of Lake Ontario.